welcome to River Writers, a production of the Writers Guild of Astoria, a 501c3 nonprofit supporting writers and the literary arts in Astoria and the Lower Columbia region. I'm your host, Marianne Monson. Aired the second Monday of each month at 9 a.m., River Writers provides a chance to peek behind the curtain at the craft of writing. What motivates writers to do the work they do, and what have they learned through their creative process? This month for River Writers, we are airing a segment of the show that was recorded by KMUN with Carl Marlantes at the Liberty Theater for as part of the Creative Writing Festival in October 2024. So please enjoy this conversation with Carl Marlantes.
But I had to tell you this funny story. So, you know, I finally got to a VA shrink, Sharon Rapp, and she's great. And she'd say, okay, talk about it. I said, well, and, you know, and I saw this guy, and we locked eyes, and I kill him. How'd you feel about that? I don't know. All right, you know, next session, next week, you know, we talk about something else. And, yeah, and then my friend, you know, fell out of the helicopter and died. And how'd you feel about that? I don't know. So the third time I did that, she got mad at me, and she said, all right, here's how it's going to be. There are only two feelings in the world, happy and sad. And I'm going to ask you how you feel about it, and you're going to have to choose happy or sad. We'll start there.
That shows how far you've come, Carl. That's a long way. That's amazing. You know, I'm curious if some of the people that you served with have read Matterhorn and what they've thought about it. They tell you you got it all wrong, or
no. I had a guy. He wasn't one of the people that I served with. But he was a Marine. He had seven Matterhorns, and he stacked them on the table. And said, "I want you to sign them all." I said, "Wow, seven? How come you're buying so many?" He said, "I've got a wife and a brother and five kids. And I can't tell them about what I did in Vietnam. I just choke up. I go golfing. I just clam up. I just can't do it. I'm going to give them each this book because it's going to tell them exactly what it was like, and I won't have to do it myself." Mm-hmm. And that made me feel pretty good. And so I've never had anybody, you know, get upset with me. I mean, I was worried about, you know, African Americans, but you know, I did a lot of research and I called my friends who were African Americans, and can I say this? Yeah, you can say that, you know. And I, you know, you got it right. Mm-hmm. It was important because racism was huge. And today, I mean, young people today will read their military guys and they'll go like, "What? There was racism in the Marine Corps?" Mm. Yeah, there was.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's impressive, you know, that they were, your friends were saying what I said about, I know, I have to admit he got it right.
Yeah.
But you've ended up having the opportunity with Matterhorn to talk with a lot of Vietnam vets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to do a lot of work with them. Has that surprised you that it ended up taking you that direction?
Yeah, it actually did. Surprise isn't the right word. I never imagined it, you know, and it just sort of fell into it because once it got out, one thing that was really very, very nice is that a young man read Matterhorn, and he said, "This sounds like what my father-in-law went through." And so he took the book to this guy named Harold Wilson, and he said, "That's us." You know, and so this son-in-law started trying to contact people, and now every summer, Charlie Company, which is my Marine company, gets together at Harold's place in North Carolina, and it's because of Matterhorn, you know. I mean, it's really nice, and I get invited to do a lot of work. You know, the other thing is a lot of special operation guys and that kind of stuff, they can't talk because it's... First of all, it's a stigma if you go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And second, because it's a lot of it's secret and I have the right clearances, I'll just listen to them. And so I find that very helpful to them, you know, and it makes me feel good. So sort of like, well, I can still, you know, pitch in and do get some good done. So yes, I mean, Matterhorn has been good that way. What It's Like has been very good that way. It's taught in all the military academies. It's taught the war colleges. And I get invited to these places and talk to the students, and that's all been very good.
Yeah. What do you think the cost to our society is when we fail to make a serious study of history?
Oh boy, stupid decisions. You know, never assume a conspiracy when just plain stupidity will suffice. I mean, we have so many examples of people who do not read history and do not learn the lessons of history. I can't tell you how many people with cold victory go like, I didn't know Finland, you know, was on the side of Germany against Russia. You know, what? You're a Finn. You should know that. Well, I have to tell you this other story. Ina, my grandmother. I said, can you define Sisu? And she looks at me and she says, yes, that's what won the Winter War in 39. Anyway, yes. Is that better? Okay.
Great. Is it true you write your books by hand?
Yes, the first drafts. I have this theory that you need to be connected to your body. And quite frankly, if you're writing on a keyboard, then you start editing at the same time. And it's like, and it takes you twice as long to get through it. And you're stopping the flow all the time. If I do it by hand, then I'm too lazy to go back and change it. So it works better. It's more visceral in my body. I don't know if that's a true theory or not. That's the way I do it.
Actually, it is true. There's good research on that.
Is there?
Yeah. That's why taking notes by hand in college courses, like, you retain more of it.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Probably helps you track your characters better. Which sometimes, we all sometimes have those moments where we forget our character. But I think you've said that your favorite moments with writing, it's like you disappear and you sort of become that.
I think that the athletes call it being in the zone. Mm. You know, the quarterback doesn't even think; he just knows where his end's going to be and tosses it, and the end's there. You know, there's some sense of being in the zone, and when you're doing writing well, you're out of the way. Mm-hmm. I think that, like, Shakespeare is my favorite example of this. Nobody knows whether he was Catholic or Protestant, whether he was gay or straight. Nobody knows anything about him. But that's because he disappeared. Yeah. And all that stuff came through him. And he got out of the way. And when that happens, I'll sometimes be in it. And I'll wake up and I'll go like, oh my God, I'm here. Wow. You know, mm-hmm. instead of in wherever the scene was. It's a wonderful feeling, you know. And it doesn't happen all the time. And the only way it happens, I'm sorry to say, you just got put yourself down on the seat at the back, around the same time every day. So your whole body says, now it's time to write. And lots of times, again, you know, you write for 4 hours, that's about what I can do. And then you come back the next day and you go, oh God, and throw it out. You have to be able to throw stuff out.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, spirituality is really woven closely throughout both of your novels. In Deep River, you have, I'm going to say her name wrong probably, Vasutati.
Vasutati.
Yeah, Vasutati. Who's a shaman native, and Ilmari seeks wisdom from her.
Ilmari. You're an Astoria now.
Yeah. When I first moved here, I said something about wanting a sauna, and the first thing they said was sauna, sauna. Okay.
You're getting there.
Yep. And in Matterhorn, you explore the conflicts, the spiritual dimension of conflicts, the sacrifice and intimacy of battle, the spiritual progression to compassion.
And a quote from Matterhorn that I just love is, he says, and speaking of Malas, your main character, he cursed God directly for the joke, the savage joke that had been played on him. And in that cursing, Malas, for the first time, really talked with his God. His cries were the rage and hurt of a newborn child roughly being taken from the womb. Comment on all of that spirituality. Are you intentional about weaving spirituality through your
totally.
Books? Or is it just
such a
part of you?
Well, it's part of me, but it's also, that novel is about becoming a real person. Parseval, it's a story of a boy becoming a man, and there's a lot of rebirth symbolism in all of our mythologies, so Melis was into politics, he was into trying to get ahead, he wanted to get a medal, surface stuff. And he had to basically, get the shit kicked out of him by God to finally go like, oh, and he's kind of reborn, pulled out, kicking and screaming. I mean, it reminds me of a great quote by Carl Jung. He said, it's too bad that people go kicking and screaming to the destiny that they would end up with anyway.
It's very untrue. Absolutely. Well, thank you. I want to ask a couple questions about Deep River for sure. We talked about the mythology and the Parseval myth, and which I had to, of course, go look up. It had been a little while. I was a little rusty on Germanic Middle Age romances. But it's really an epic covering 30 years of a family's evolution, the Koski family. Did I say that one right?
Koski.
Koski. Do not speak Finnish. And focus on the Finnish immigrants who settled this area, which I didn't realize before I read the novel. Like, I knew that there were a lot of Finnish immigrants, but I didn't realize that it was really a result of the Russian conflict that was going on, that was leading to waves of immigration.
Yeah, my grandmother's brothers basically left because they didn't want to get drafted.
Yeah.
And if you got drafted into the Russian army, 20 years.
Wow.
It was no joke.
Yeah.
As Biden would say, no joke.
That's incredible. So your Finnish grandmother was a card-carrying Red.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, a Red.
Like
definitely.
The people who built my house. I told you.
That's right.
My house was built by Finnish immigrants in 1914. It's an upper town in Astoria. And when I was restoring it, I found beneath the layers of flooring material, they had used the Finnish newspaper that was published here in Astoria, which was a very socialist communist newspaper.
I'll have to tell you about newspapers. I'd come up and visit my grandmother in Astoria. I live in Seaside. And on the kitchen table would be what I thought was the local Astoria paper, which was called the Daily Worker. It wasn't until I was in high school that I realized, that isn't the Astoria paper.
And somewhere I read that your grandmother wouldn't let you play with the children.
That's right. No, yeah. I mean, I came home once. I was staying at her house, and I came home with this little boy. We'd met, and we played. And then I said, oh, come over to the house, and we'll do something at grandma's house. And he walked in, and my grandmother just shoot him out. Get out of here. You go home. I don't want you in our house. You go home. And I was like, I'm like about 8 or 9. I was like, why, grandma? They're church Finns. He's from church Finns. We don't like them. Oh. Yeah, and it's still in Astoria in the 50s, church Finns were white and grandma was red.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that generation has died out, so I think that's kind of calmed down a bit in Astoria. But it was real. It was real, but it's still in the 50s because the Civil War was only 30 or 40 years old and all those people lived through it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you remember that you really had to speak multiple languages to work in the shops as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah. Yeah, in the 50s, you didn't get hired with a retail job unless you spoke either Finnish or Norwegian.
Yeah. Yeah, I've read contemporary newspapers where they talk about walking about down the streets of Astoria and you can hear 10 different languages spoken on a given day.
It was really great.
Yeah. Amazing. So for those of us who love Astoria and this area, the whole lower Columbia, reading your book is a chance to walk the streets.
For those of you who are just joining us, this is Marianne Monson for KMUN's River Writers, sponsored by the Writers Guild. This morning, we are airing a segment of show from October 2024 and the Creative Writing Festival at the Liberty Theater, where author Carl Marlantes was speaking about his work.
There's places like Suomi Hall, Tapiola, Labor Temple. They start to make so much more sense, right? And even our co-op, like there's a long tradition here of cooperative businesses.
Absolutely,
yeah. So how did the landscape provide both inspiration and research for your novel?
How did it provide inspiration?
Inspiration and research, yeah.
Well, the research is I just grew up in Seaside, which then was a logging town, and we'd get on our bikes and go out to the logging shows because it was really fascinating, and they'd shoo us away, and then we'd sneak around the other side and watch, you know. So I was around logging because I just was curious about it, a little kid, and I was always out in the woods. And it was so much freedom in those days. I'd tell my parents, I'd be like about 12, and I'd have my little 22, and I'd go out, and I'd say, well, I'm going to go out in the woods. I think I'll come back tomorrow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was fine, you know. Just check in tomorrow, you know. So I grew up, you know, in this area, you know, around the logging, around the woods. My grandfather was a fisherman, and I worked for him in the summers, which I hated. You know, I mean, can you really believe this? Okay, it's the boat's going up and down, water sloshing over the bows, we're trying to get the net in, and we finally get it. I tell my grandfather, I said, this is not fair. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm getting seasick, and all my friends work in restaurants, and all the girls come and talk to them, and they get to eat all the ice cream that they want, and... And I could just imagine my grandfather thinking, I left Finland to raise this? You know? But anyway, the landscape's in my blood. And I didn't have to do much research.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And really? Yeah, really. You just grew up around it.
I grew up around it. Yeah.
Like the IWW, the labor conflict?
Well, those I had to research.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like the massacre in whatever town that is. Yeah.
And
a lot about the labor history in Chicago and all that. Yeah, that's all reading. And one of the things I do that I don't know if other historians do or historical novel writers, if you want to get a feel for the time period, you don't get it out of history books. I get it by reading contemporary fiction.
Yeah.
So if you want to know what society life is in New York in 1900, read Edith Wharton. Don't read a history book because you'll get the feel of it. And I did that with the Finnish books. I read books by Väinö Linna and Under a North Star and The Maid Silja. These are all Finnish books that were written at the time. And so you get a feel for it. And that helps a novelist.
You get more of the language, too, don't you think?
You get
because
the music.
They use different terms
Absolutely.
Someone now would use writing about that period. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I want to touch on the labor history because, you know, that the labor movement is a time period that we don't think about too much, talk about too much, study too much, you know? But you really bring to life like the violence and the risk and the conflict involved with it. So, and it sounds like your grandmother really brought that alive for you, but then you dove into it more.
Yeah, right. I mean, she wasn't involved in a lot of violence. I mean, she did talk about, you know, when they go to a meeting, they'd have to take the rifles sometimes.
Wow.
Because they were afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, but... she was never involved in, you know, any of the horrible incidences or anything, but it was just that they were much maligned, and they actually won every lawsuit. They won every lawsuit, and people, you know. But when I grew up, it was like, well, the IWW, a bunch of radicals that are, you know, trying to destroy our world. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, but that's newspapers that take a side.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it was. And, you know, we have siloed news now. We had siloed news then, too. It just wasn't quite as widespread.
I think that was a lot of the rebranding going up to World War I, too, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, it was very intentional revisionist history, like branding that, basically saying they're all radicals.
Yeah.
Radicals who want weekends.
Right, I know.
Things like
8-hour days. I mean, that's a terrible. Yeah.
Compensation when someone's foot
overtime.
Gets cut off. Yeah. I want to take some questions from the audience, and you can tell us too if there's anything you wanted to touch on.
I've talked enough.
Okay, let's see. This is an audience question. What mistakes and misjudgments were made that led the U.S. into an ill-advised, disastrous entry into the Vietnam War?
Okay.
Probably another all-night
question. It's not exactly a novelist question, but I'm game. I obviously have thought about it. Look, here's my take on it. First of all, bureaucracy. They didn't allow Ho Chi Minh to put his case before American politicians. I don't know who made those decisions, but the letters he wrote, all that stuff, and then the OSS was in there working with him against the Japanese. And again, somehow it never got up to the decision makers that this guy actually wasn't trying to, you know, take over the world. But what was going on, I think, is that all those decision makers, the Bundys, Johnson, the Kennedys, they were all World War II veterans. And they really did have to fight against dictators that were trying to take over the world. So when they saw Ho Chi Minh, they said, here he comes again. You know, and I think it was just a mindset. Mm-hmm. I don't get mad at them for that. I mean, it was a policy error, but I think it came out of their experience fighting real dictators who really were trying to hurt a lot of people. And they just thought the same thing. And instead of seeing him as a nationalist, they saw him as a communist. And so we sided with, let's face it, a corrupt Southern government and got ourselves tangled up in it. And the Kennedys, when they gave the go-ahead to murder Jim, we owned the war. I mean, it was like, because then the legitimate president of South Vietnam was murdered and we allowed it. And it was like, now it's our war. So we got into it, and we only could get out, you know, if we just admitted that it was wrong, and finally we did. What I fault them for, and I get angry about still, is lying about it. You know, I mean, McNamara wrote Johnson a memo in 1965 saying we can't win this because it's not a war that is about military stuff. It's about political stuff. And we only had about 2,000 dead at that time. We ended up with close to 60,000 dead, and because Johnson said, I got an election to win, so we're not going to talk about that.
Yeah,
and that was that I get angry about.
Yeah, at one point in the novel, you talk about your character realizing that the Vietnamese soldiers have so much more on the line, right? That they have forever because their homeland is being invaded, and that the soldiers, U.S. soldiers, just have until the next election.
Yeah, no, that's true. But one of the tragedies is that I've talked to Vietnamese veterans who were fought in the NVA Army. They can't say it out loud, but they can say it in private. They fought for freedom and democracy and all that stuff, and they ended up with a corrupt totalitarian government.
Yeah.
It's like their war didn't work out too well for them either.
No. But a lot of times, you know, wars don't work out that well for anybody, in my opinion.
I think you could say that. Yeah.
Okay, this is another audience question. When you have a vague idea of a story and character, what is your process to fully develop them into a compelling plot? Do you create a document and jot ideas? How do you get meat on the bones from your wisp of an idea? Specifics, please. What is your process?
That's a good, easy question. Look, for example, if I get an image, an old woman looking out of the window, and then I think, how do I fill in the life that I suspect she must have led? Hmm. And I start trying to put myself in her skin. And then I try to put myself in her skin when she's 15, And I think it's sort of the same thing I'm talking about readers being able to get out of their own skins. When you're writing and you get a glimmer, my belief is that that glimmer has come from your unconscious. Mm-hmm. It is there to hook you into something. And then you grab onto it. It's like a dream, you know. And then how do you unravel the dream? Well, you can analyze a dream and kill it, I think. But what happens is it evokes characters that are inside of you. And those inside characters are, again, parts of you that you can start to imagine you are them. And that is how you develop a character. Now, there's all kinds of things about character arcs and all that stuff, which is just, you know, it's... But as far as the plot lines are concerned, I basically am concerned with the character arc. And then I think about how can I run this character from being, you know, Melis, who is self-centered and, you know, a little bit immature, to a whole person. And so then the plot sort of comes out of trying to figure out an interesting way to keep the reader reading and have his character develop over the course of the novel. And I did that with the characters, and all my characters are kind of like that, that they're... I firmly believe that you don't make them up. They're inside of you. Mm. And all you do is get them out.
All your characters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Male and female.
Both, yeah.
Yep. They're all part of you.
Yes.
So I think something you said there is actually really fascinating. You said you start with images, powerful images that like are stuck in your mind, basically. You know, that image of your grandmother. And then you attempt empathy, which is going mm-hmm. into the skin, right?
Yeah.
And I think your work really shows that process, like the benefit of that process, because it's very visual. Like it creates a reader, mm-hmm. a picture in the reader's mind. And then it also just pulls us in. So that's wonderful, really profound advice, actually, I think, for all of us who...
One of the things about novels is also that is really important is that details. A lot of writers will say, well, the dog came in the kitchen. No, the German Shepherd came in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
No, the 120-pound German Shepherd came in the kitchen. See, you pile the details up, and then the image is strong. Mm-hmm. If you just say the dog came in the kitchen, it's you know, nothing there.
Generic.
But you put the details in, and then it's like real.
Mm-hmm. The specifics ground us in that scene. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and I just want to mention, too, that Susan Banias, who's presenting for us tomorrow at the conference, did a wonderful interview with you.
Yes,
and I think
she did.
Collected some of those images. So if anybody would like to see some of the images that Carl's describing, you can go to Susan's, it's in Oregon Art Watch. Yeah, and that article has a number of those beautiful photographs.
Thank you for joining us today on River Writers, and thanks to Carl Marlantes, who joined us for the Astoria Creative Writing Festival in October 2024. The Writers Guild of Astoria is a 501c3 nonprofit organization promoting the literary arts and serving writers in the Lower Columbia region. You can learn more and become a member by visiting thewritersguild.org. Until next time, keep the words flowing and your pencil sharp. I'm Marianne Monson for River Writers.